I'm Christopher Lighton in Cairo, listening with the celebrated young Egyptian historian Khaled Fahmy for the long view of this Arab upheaval, a world historical event we knew for sure 2 years ago when peaceful protests in Tahrir Square overpowered a dictatorship. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, in a traveling series with Arab artists in a revolution. And historians are artists in one of the great arts. Khaled Fahmy, I want to just plunge with a line you wrote last summer during the open campaign to elect a Democratic president. The choice, you said at that point, was between military fascism or the deep state on one side and the religious populism of the Muslim Brotherhood on the other. And you said what Egypt really needed was a third way, a candidate of non-military, non-religious, civil society, a candidate, so to speak, of the courts, the schools, the universities, the press institutions, which are very well-founded, in fact, in Egypt. Here was your line. It is the poetry, not the politics, of the third way that promises salvation. That's my kind of line. What did you mean by it?
I was struck by the poetry from day one of this revolution. People study political science to make sense of the revolution. I think it's the art, it's the poetics that really matter. I find it not completely coincidental that the slogan of the revolution, the people demand the downfall of the regime, which in Arabic says "Ash-Sha'b yurid isqat al-Nizam," is actually a slight morphing of a famous verse of poetry that was coined nearly a century ago by a Tunisian a poet. So it's not a complete coincidence that it's in Tunisia and in Egypt that we had these first big revolutions, because and the poet, the poem, basically the verse basically says that if people demand something, then fate has to give in. And we change it a bit and we say people demand the downfall of the regime, and this is what we accomplished. And it's the poetry of it that that matters. I can tell you exactly when it is that I first heard the slogan on the 25th of January, when I went to Tahrir to save my nephew, who had been nearly kidnapped by the police forces because he went with his mother, my sister, to demonstrate against the police forces. Anyway, I went there and I remember distinctly hearing that slogan for the first time. And I had goosebumps all over my body that I could not believe the poetry of it, the poignant language and the self-confidence. It's a classical Arabic. It's not colloquial Arabic. It's classical Arabic, the slogan, which is rare in Egypt, but that is what this was the moment. So it was an amazing, electrifying moment throughout Tahrir Square, where at that time it was about 5,000, 10,000 people. And what I noticed, and of course later on it mushroomed into tens and hundreds of thousands of people over the 18 days, the subsequent 18 days. But throughout these 18 days, I remember distinctly feeling the sense of self-confidence that people had, which is something that, as someone who's been, you know, an Egyptian living here and so on, we have never seen it. When people take to the streets, it was throughout the past 100 years, really. It's either a religious fervor or anti-colonial fervor, you know, demonstrating against the war in Iraq and or against Israel, or for Nasser and of the 60s and Arab nationalism, with an important, in my reading, tinge of military rule. I mean, Nasser, after all, was a military general, I mean, an officer. And so this is new. This is completely different. This is what I thought is is what we need and what we want, and I think what we are already having, a third wave. So this is something else. It's not yet articulate, and it's a very much intimidated voice right now, intimidated by the Islamists and intimidated by the military. We managed to get the military out. When I wrote these words, I didn't really believe it. I thought we would, you know, I would not see it in my lifetime. I didn't think that the military would go back to their barracks so soon. But the revolution, in my mind, was struggling against these two formidable odds. The Muslim Brotherhood on the one hand, and the military, long military rule and logic and mentality on the other. And right now we got rid of one of them, and we have this very, very deep other serious problem and serious issue to deal with, which is how to deal with political Islam, what's the role of Islam in politics, more specifically, what do we do with the Muslim Brotherhood, how do we understand them, and how to make them more democratic. It's a huge challenge. But I believe that there's something that this revolution has triggered, which is this self-confidence that people have and the feeling that they are no longer guests in their country, the feeling that they can shape their history, the feeling that the destiny is theirs, the future is theirs. And this is something that many people in the West take for granted. We don't. And I lived in this country long enough to realize that most people feel guests in Egypt, in their own country. So to reverse this around and to manage to affect this phenomenal change is something that I never thought I would live long enough to.
It's fascinating because you're voicing an optimism that we don't hear anymore in the West, and even amongst certain people in Egypt, that the collective consciousness, agency, determination, vision is still alive.
Yes, I mean, many people have become demoralized over the past, 18 months or 20 months. And many people in the West lost interest and lost hope in what this revolution can bring about. And definitely many, many people in Egypt, including the revolutionaries, including many of my friends, have become very despondent and demoralized. But I think this is it strikes much, much deeper roots. Mm. And I think we're overwhelmed. Definitely. And it doesn't take more than simply recounting what we have managed to accomplish for people to look back and say, yes, it's not too bad, not bad at all. And then they get energized for the coming round of confrontation. And then something happens and we're back, you know, to this dark gray area. And then something else happens and we're back and energized. These days is the anniversary of the so-called Muhammad Mahmoud incidents. This is when more than 50 people died in a week of confrontation last year. And people are galvanized. They remember what happened, and we have in a series of festivities and commemorations in the coming few days. And people are saying, no, we will not let them die in vain. You know, we have to continue the struggle. And, you know, this is not going to be over soon. This is a long, long, long struggle. This is a very complex situation in Egypt, and it will not be over in a day or a week.
Khaled Fahmy, there's a personal story here that I want us to get to about how you, sort of pursuing a world career in Europe and the United States, came back here before the events on some sort of intuition that you wanted to be there when it happened. But first, just play historian, if you will, on sort of two tacks. One, can you place Tahrir Square and everything you associate it with along a timeline of modern Arab history, certainly of the last, say, 200 years since Napoleon, but as far back as you want to go. And then I want to ask you if you can imagine a sort of biography of this revolution in Tahrir Square, where it came from, what its antecedents were. But first, on the long line of the history of the Arab peoples. What kind of a bump is this?
This is a very big bump. I mean, there's an Egyptian story and an Arab one. Within the Arab one, what we're seeing, because it's not only in Egypt, if we think about Egypt, I mean, Egypt and Syria and Libya and all the other countries, what we're seeing is, I think, a very important reversal, if not a serious challenge to the trajectory of Arab history over the past, I would say, 100 years. The modern Arab state system, you know, the borders we see and these countries and so on, this is a concoction of basically the First World War. These countries came into being after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire following the end of the First World War. Many of the countries did not exist. I mean, five countries, I mean, if not more, Syria, Lebanon, Transjordan, Iraq and Palestine did not exist. There were no countries with these names before then. And Saudi Arabia also, let alone the Gulf. I mean, all of this is in a sense, new countries. Of course, the societies are old. I mean, Damascus is the oldest city in the world. But Syria as a nation state is new. And that is precisely the dilemma that the Arabs have found themselves in. There was a big Arab revolt of Lawrence of Arabia during the First World War in the hope that after the war there would be one unified Arab nation under one unified leadership. And there is, and the end result was the exact opposite, parceling out these countries and having these complacent, weak leaders who basically didn't do the people's bidding. They did somebody else's bidding. Mm-hmm. And they were taking their cue from London and Paris, later on from Moscow and Washington, and very little attention to the demands of people in their own countries. So you can read, actually, modern Arab history as a history of oil, if you want, of the Arab-Israeli conflict, of Islam, political Islam, of tyranny and oppression, lack of democracy. But somehow in all of this story, the Arab people do not feature. They're not an important player. And all of a sudden, with these revolts, the Arab people are the main player, not only a player, but are an important player. Of course, they're struggling hard to find a voice. They're struggling also against all odds, especially in Syria, with a huge, huge price to be paid in blood. Now, Egypt is slightly different because Egypt is slightly ahead in these of these countries. So the process of building a nation state, forget the pharaohs and the pyramids and so on, we're talking about 200 years, basically, of state building, of the institutions you mentioned, of the judiciary, of the press, of the schools, of the universities, of a bureaucracy, of an army, of a police. All of these institutions are about 150, 170 years old in Egypt. That's the history of the modern Egyptian state. So we are slightly ahead. We're about 80, 100 years ahead of our neighbors in this process. And in that sense, our middle class and our institutions are more robust. And we had also had our failed revolutions in 1919, 1952, and earlier in 1882. So there is a history of revolutions and a history of frustrations. So this revolution, in my mind, is a continuation of that. And the way I specifically read it with regards Egyptian history as such is as follows, that modern Egyptian history is a struggle between the people and the state. There is a Leviathan state that was created effectively out of the army at the beginning of the 19th century with the so-called founder of modern Egypt, Muhammad Ali, or Mehmed Ali, if you want to choose the Turkish pronunciation of his name, a very able statesman who founded a modern state with no contractual relationship with the people. In fact, with no contractual relationship with anybody except his kinsmen and family. And with blood. And that is the modern Egyptian state. It's an essentially tyrannical state, an essentially undemocratic state. And we've struggled so hard to try and limit the power of that state and to subject it to constitutional rule. We failed in so many attempts. We failed for various reasons. One of them is oil. The region is swash with oil, an oil money that is in the hands of very reactionary regimes. We suffered because of colonialism, like Tunisia. Egypt and Tunisia are the first countries that had constitutions. Egypt and Tunisia were the first countries to be invaded by Britain and France, respectively, immediately after establishing our constitutions in 1881 for Tunisia, in 1882 for Egypt. And then we had the Arab-Israeli conflict. So three calamities, colonialism, the Arab-Israeli conflict, and the curse of oil, holding us back, us, I mean the people of Egypt, from trying to curb the power of the Egyptian state. And I think finally we cracked it. This is how I see it. Okay. Finally, in 2011, we managed for the first time in 5,000 years to bring down an Egyptian ruler and to put him on trial and to send him to prison. That has never happened in 5,000 years of Egyptian history.
Fantastically interesting. Now the biography, so to speak, of this moment. It's growing up. It's rite of passage into history there in January last year.
Yes, it's not born out of the Facebook movement, as okay. people sometimes think. It has much deeper roots. And if one thinks about Egyptian revolutionary history, it goes all the way back to the 1820s. There's hardly a decade that passed in Egypt without one major uprising against local government or the central government or foreign rule. So what we are seeing is a culmination of this. It's very instinctive. It's not that people went and read their history, but it is there. And in that manner, it's not a complete accident that people took to Tahrir. There's something symbolic and significant about Tahrir as a site. Tahrir is the center of the city, geographically. It's the epicenter of the city. It's a huge, unplanned, empty spot in the middle of the city. It used to be, and that is key, the headquarters of the Egyptian army of occupation, of the British army of occupation. Yes. From the 1880s to 1946, that is where the army, the British army of occupation was. It was located there. And that, in a sense, is where Egypt was ruled from. The embassy, the British embassy, was further blocks south. The royal palace was to the east, but that is how the country was ruled, by sheer brute force. And the beginnings of modern Cairean demonstrations instinctively would go to Tahrir. Mm. And when the British left and the area was vacated, and the result is what you see now, is this huge empty area, unplanned. This, you know, effectively became a roundabout. That became the symbolic center for the conscience of the nation. There's no symbols. There is no statues. There's no monuments. It's just an empty spot. But that is where people would go and congregate, because that is also where people could go and talk to each other. Egyptian cities, Cairo included, is designed in such a way as to prevent people from congregating and talking. We don't have public spaces. We don't have parks. We don't have a public space. And this Tahrir is one such graphic example of the way in which we were governed. A huge empty space with no trees, blazing sun, with no benches, with no possibility of meeting fellow citizens. What happened then on the 18th during these 18 days is precisely this. We managed to take the center of the city. We managed to bring the city and the entire country to a standstill. And we managed to bring down the regime. But most significantly, we started talking to each other. That is what I think is most significant.
You know, among other things, I keep wondering what, if anything, is being repeated here. You say this was a peculiar once in 5,000 years sort of event, but I've also wondered, you know, watching Tahrir Square, whether what was being repeated there 2 years ago against Uncle Sam's friend Mubarak wasn't a version of the riots against the British in 1919. In other words, in what sense is this a cycle of anti-imperial protest?
I'm not sure that the anti-imperial dimension was significant in this revolution. And I say this because of the following. Nasser was conspicuously absent from these 18 days and subsequent days. Nasser is the quintessential symbol of anti-imperialism. He's the icon of anti-imperialist movement in Egypt and throughout the Arab world. So a third worldist, anti-imperial, anti-colonial, anti-American, anti-Western position, you would see Nasser. And in all previous demonstrations, because as I said, this is not coming out of nothing, especially since 2003 with the invasion of Iraq, Tahrir witnessed many demonstrations. In all of these demonstrations, Nasser was big. You would see the Nasserite party itself, but also non-Nasserite partisans, I mean non-partisan followers of Nasser, hoisting his picture. And singing 1960 song and raising 1960 slogans and thinking about Arab nationalism along these lines, especially the demonstrations in solidarity with Palestine and against Israel. And these coincided, the anti-Iraq, anti-war in Iraq movement and the demonstrations against the Israeli blockade of Gaza, in which the Egyptian government had been complicit and is still complicit. So the demonstrations in Tahrir in the years before the Arab Spring had these blends in them. And Nasser was there. And his picture was there. Interestingly, in these 18 days, Nasser was not there. And people did not have slogans against the United States or Israel or Saudi Arabia or all the other reactionary regimes. Not that people were not aware of them.
It's so subtle. I mean, I wonder, were they censoring themselves? I also wonder what they were thinking under their breath. Almost everything I know about Egypt I learned from the novels of Najib Mahfouz. And when he writes about 1939 or so, the young people in his novels are thoroughly aware of the evil of Hitler and fascism, but they want Germany to beat Britain because of Britain's record in Egypt and the cruelty here. It's very mixed. I wonder, in 2011 and 2012, you know, in what sense is the United States in the background of the nightmare they were responding to?
It's very much at the back of their minds. In the following sense, I think we've tried this route many times before. We've tried the routes of attacking the near enemy using Qaeda terms, because this is Ayman al-Zawahiri of Al-Qaeda. There's the near enemy and the far enemy, yeah. Big Satan. So let's attack Big Satan in order to bring down the small Satan at home. We've tried this method before. And I think, in other words, making the connection between the backer of local tyranny and local tyranny itself. So everybody knows that Mubarak is supported by Washington and by Tel Aviv and by Riyadh. And we've tried demonstrating against the United States and against Israel. Now, however, we have him. We are finally face to face with our local tyrant. And And I think this is the most significant thing. People were not looking for a cue from Washington. They were not looking for what the United States would do or what Israel would do. We know, of course, that they gave him up in the very last minute and they supported him to the very last minute. But that was really inconsequential. I was in Tahrir. I went there. We were not tuning to the BBC to find out how the demonstration is being covered. We were concentrating on the task at hand, which is bringing down this regime peacefully through local demonstration and strikes and sit-ins. And that is what we managed to do. And later on, we'll sort out the anti-revolutionary forces locally, regionally, and globally. But right now, and that is very significant, you know, that reversal. It's not obliviousness of what where Washington is. Everybody knows that Washington is very much against this. Everybody in Tahrir, at least. But we don't care. And this is what I mean by the self-confidence. We make our history, and it is not local rulers, and it's not the local, sorry, the regional balance of power, and it is not a reflection of international politics anymore. We've tried this in the 60s. The result was a catastrophic defeat in 67. We've tried it in the 70s and 80s, and the result is a continuation of the tyranny. Nothing happened. And that is why this is different.
Khaled Fahmy, take a historian's crack at another sort of maybe emotional or cultural way of looking at Tahrir. As a revolt against the sort of local rule that father knows best, that daddy runs the household and politics runs like a family.
No, I think you're absolutely right. There's a gender dimension in the sense that this is a revolution very much against the patriarchal logic of the Egyptian state. That is the state that basically says, I mean, treats people as treats its citizens as children, infantilizes them, and tells them, "You don't know. We know best. We understand," and that, I think, is what Nasser is. I'll come to the gender dimension, but let me elaborate on this generational thing, because there is a generational dimension as well. I mean, Mubarak is, he was over 80 when he's toppled. This is a young society. More than half the population is under 30. So Mubarak is actually two generations removed from the majority of the people living in Egypt. And he's not a father figure. He's a grandfather figure without being grandfatherly. So he's your quintessential patriarchal figure who actually does not know anything. You know, he pretends to know best, but he actually doesn't. He's out of touch. He's out of sync. And we made him out of power. And but that is the logic of the modern Egyptian state, from Muhammad Ali all the way to Mubarak, a very condescending state that treats its citizens as subjects as best, as children at worst. They try and strike a deal. I mean, basically, Nasser told us, we, that is the state, will handle your social and economic rights and demands in return for you giving up your political demands. That was the deal that he gave the Egyptian people. And the result, again, was 67. Now, let me stop at 67, because I think there is a connection. 67 was a catastrophic defeat. Not a normal defeat, like a devastating defeat. Militarily, 90% of our equipment was lost. 93% of our aircraft was lost in 20 minutes. This is not a six-day war. This is a 20-minute war. It was over in the early hours of the 5th of June, 1967. On the 9th of June, when the scale of the defeat became clear to masses in Tahrir and elsewhere in Egypt, people took to the streets and did something really bizarre. Rather than ask Nasser and his clique to leave and to put them on trial for this catastrophic defeat, they actually asked him to rescind his resignation and to stay in power. Mm. And this is really, really bizarre. And the only explanation I can give is that we had become so infantilized that we couldn't do without a father. We wanted him. We wanted him to stay, come what may. And we basically told him, no, you cannot leave us. Nasser rescinded his resignation and went back to office. And 3 years later, he died. In my mind, he wasn't really buried. We buried Nasser. We finally killed Nasser in 2011. We finally killed our father in January of 2011. When we said, and I witnessed it in various ways, not only was this a revolution of the young against the old, it was actually, interestingly, a leaderless revolution. We didn't want leaders. We didn't want these charismatic leaders. There were many potentials, you know, who could come and step in. But Tahrir was, as a unit, as a site, with all its logistics and the feeding and the organization, you know, to sustain a sit-in of, let's say, 100,000 people for 18 days is not easy. No. We did this for 18 days, and we brought down one of the most stable regimes in the region. The people who managed this instinctively and also consciously refused to play the father figure, refused to step in and become charismatic leaders. And when they were hailed after the revolution, many of them came online and on TV and on paper and in print and said, do not turn us into heroes. We are not heroes. And there is an amazing quality of the leadership that was born in Tahrir of dissipating itself immediately when they go home. Hmm. And it was, in a sense, the square running itself without leaders. And in that sense, I see what happened in January, especially the 28th of January, when we brought down the police force, when we came out in huge numbers, and that's when things flipped, and the regime basically fell on the 28th of January. In a sense, that is what we should have done on the 9th and 10th of June, 1967. It took us 40 years, and 40 plus years. But I think this is what it was all about. Killing the father figure, doing away with these charismatic leaders, and having trust in ourselves, as messy as this can be. And we're living in a mess. Now, to come back to your question about how does this affect women, which is very, very important, because there is not only a generational dimension, but also a gender dimension in all of this. Not as pronounced, but it is there. It's lurking under the surface because it's one of the tyrannies that we're living under. It's women and men. I went to Tahrir because of my sister. She had beat me in Tahrir. She went with her son, 15-year-old. And she had been on the street way before I am, for the previous years. And she, like many other women, are struggling on the street against various things. You know, everyone has their own axe to grind. Her issue is street children. She's concerned about street children and the lack of protection they get from this very oppressive regime. And this is what she's been struggling against. So she was there and other women. Now, my sister could have been arrested the way other women were. And I remember distinctly the infamous case of Samira Ibrahim, a young Egyptian woman from the countryside, from a very conservative part of the country, from the south, who had happened to come to Cairo, this is 2 months after Mubarak fell, for some errand. And then she finds a demonstration in Tahrir Square. So she joins. And then the military police arrest her. They arrest her because she is a demonstrator, but primarily because she's a woman. Because women protesters, in the eyes of the military police, are effectively with no honor. They're sluts. We can do with them what we want. They are basically, and this is the word they use, they are prostitutes. They don't care. They sleep in the street. They sleep with fellow male protesters. They will not be ashamed of anything. They arrested them. They took them to a military prison, and they subjected them to a very humiliating so-called virginity test. Now, Samira was broken, but she was not defeated. She went back home. She had a chat with her father. And out of this chat, she came out determined because her father helped her and told her, don't give up. And she never gave up. She came back to Cairo and sued the military. She sued the military. She leveled charges against the head of the Egyptian armed forces for subjecting her to cruel and humiliating practice. She lost the legal battle, but I've seen her many times in Tahrir. I see her many times on Twitter and in Facebook. She has not given up, and there is a very strong movement being built around people like her to fight another battle. So she lost a battle, but the war is far from being over. And we know this. This is 200 years of tyranny, 200 years of oppression, 200 years of patriarchal rule. They will not be reversed in 18 days.
Or even 2 years. Khaled Fahmy, come back to your personal story. You homed back to Cairo with some sort of intuition, dream maybe, but this was going to be the story of your lifetime. How did you know? And how's it going?
I came back in September of 2010 to start a new job in the American University in Cairo. I had been, over my many years in the United States, I spent 18 years in the United States. I study Egypt and I work on Egypt. My family is here and I am a regular visitor and I spend my sabbatical leaves in Egypt and all my summer vacations here. So on my repeated visits to Egypt, especially the past, let's say, 5 years, 5 years prior to the revolution, I saw something fascinating. The energy among the youth was fascinating. And I started writing very irregularly about this. And I remember one article I wrote about a confrontation between the Egyptian prime minister in 2006, I think it was, 2008, and a young university student in Cairo University, where the prime minister had gone to give a speech. And after he finished, this guy stood up and said, let go of Egypt, prime minister. And this is after they had been screened. Of course, not any student could attend. Despite the screening, despite all of the indoctrination, turns out this is a kid, one of the founders of the now famous 6th of April movement, a youth movement, a kind of liberal movement, secular, that, you know, wanted Egypt to be released. They didn't think, but the sagacity and the eloquence and the self-confidence was amazing. Subsequent to this, many women joined and became famous. And then I started noticing an internet radio station. This is called Teat Radio. And I was following it from the States, and I was, you know, stunned by the imagination and the art and the new voice, completely new voice, completely new names, people I've never heard from before, who are witty and sarcastic and intelligent and crafty. And they were playing with words and music, glossing over current weekly events. And each week they would release a 5-minute segment. I still have them. They are gems. They are collector's items. And then I wrote an article about them. I wrote the article. It got published. The first response was from them. They're that savvy. They're that connected. They spotted it. They spotted my article in an obscure newspaper, but they spotted it. They said, "We were, you know, this is the best thing that was written about us. We'd love to meet you." My following trip to Egypt, the first thing I did from the airport, before going home, I went to see them in the studio downtown Cairo. It was fascinating, you know, 6 or 7 young men, no women, sadly. Even though they are aware of gender, they are aware of gender issues, but I sat with them and I was just stunned by how creative and at ease and confident they were. And then there is the local, the downtown Cairo art scene. Interesting plays, some poetry recitals, movies, and mobile telephone movies. Very, very interesting, very creative. So new media, these are, of course, young people who are savvy with technology, who are creative with it, they are at ease with it, and they make all kinds of things completely out of the box, have nothing to do with the state, and they're not angry. I mean, they are angry, but that's not it. That's not the key to their character, and that is different. It's different from the Islamists, and it's different from the Nasserites. Mm. This is a new generation. They have their own media, they have their own voice, and they have something to say. There's a lot to complain about, but there is also a lot to celebrate and a lot to talk about in creative ways. And finally, the very vibrant civil society movement and organizations, especially the human rights groups, you know, mushrooming from the beginnings in the mid-1980s and then mushrooming into the late 1990s. Very, very intelligent, new language, new discourse, new issues, and they really changed the public discourse. So I would look around and I say, my God, there's something happening. There's something happening in this country. Mm. And I said this publicly. Of course, I could not anticipate what happened. I mean, no one could. But I felt something is up in the air. And I said this in New York, where I was living, and I said this here. I told them, look, guys, something is happening in Egypt. Don't think political. You know, this is where I got it wrong. Yeah. I said, it's not political. What we're going to see in Egypt is not political. There is a cultural revolution taking place among the youth. I could never think that it will spill over into politics the way it did. But something was happening, and I noticed it, and I think many people, many besides me, noticed it. And when I came and when I mean, there's an interesting story. I mean, we felt something is happening even politically. I mean, the tension was building up and the tensions simmering beneath the surface was amazing. We had a very big bomb blowing up in Alexandria on New Year's Eve, on the 1st of January 2011, in a church in Alexandria, killing dozens. And people suspected that this was the work of the regime. And
Forgive me. Do they still suspect that?
Well, now with things happening, it kind of eclipsed. I mean, people hardly remember this incident. But when they do mention it, we still don't know who committed it. And there's big question marks about it. But there was so much inflamed feelings about it that, again, I said, we have to do something. Not, I mean, I felt we had to do something. And sure enough, there were calls to demonstrate. Now, demonstrations had been going on for the previous, let's say, 5-6 months, ever since the young Alexandrian man, Khaled Said, was tortured to death, who became the icon of the revolution. again, this was new. The demonstrations, the style was new. When he was killed, I was still in New York, and I received an SMS from my friends in Egypt, one of my friends in Egypt, who had been to one of the demonstrations protesting against the brutal way in which this young Alexandrian man was killed. And she had told me that she had received a message from the organizers telling her, telling people to take to the streets, to go to the river, to the Nile, to stay silent with a black t-shirt with their backs to the city, facing the water, facing the river, and the back to the city. No slogans, no shouting, no banners, no talking, not even to themselves. So it's a silent vigil. So she went that day and she sent me an SMS saying, come back home, something is happening. It's the style of protest that was new. So 6 months later, this demonstration happened. I mean, this bombing happened. And we wanted to have a demonstration. And they said on the 7th, the eve of the Coptic Christmas, we take to the streets in protest what happened in front of the church in Alexandria. Wearing black, it was very cold that day, wearing black, going to the river, both in Cairo and in Alexandria. Alexandria standing in front of the Mediterranean, in Cairo standing in front of the Nile, with our backs to the city, with no slogans, no banners. I called my sister and I told her, are you going? She said, yeah, I'm already there. I told her where. She told me, you know, on one spot of the Nile, close to here. And she said, where are you going? I said, on the bridge leading to Tahrir, Qasr al-Nil Bridge. And I remember asking her, I told her, so do you think it will be big? She said, yeah, I have a feeling it will be large. In the taxi going to my spot, I passed by her, and there were 8 demonstrators. And when I reached my spot, there were about 15. And that was it. But there was a feeling that some, you know, because I remember asking it distinctly, do you think it will be today? Will it flip today? And she said, I think so. There was something. So what changed, what flipped the thing is, of course, the fall of Ben Ali in Tunisia and the feeling that, well, if it happened in Tunisia, it can happen here. And with some proper organization, we can tap into this feeling of anger and of frustration and the new tactics and the new symbols and the new organizational skills that are floating around in the region. And all of this came together on the 28th of January, when all of a sudden it is now 100,000, 200,000 people in Tahrir.
Khaled Fahmy, you've gone out of your way to stay in touch with ordinary people here, and it's the wildest dream that we brought to Cairo, to tap somehow into not just the talking heads, but the ordinary people, what they're feeling and also what they're intuiting. Give us a lesson. How do we do it? You're reminding me why, from the outset, you know, I wanted to hear what artists were saying about it, because that's their job, after all, is to see pictures whole and see them ahead of time. But where do you go, and where would you point us?
I'll tell you a story about one interesting encounter I had with a woman I had never met, and I have never met since. But it was in Tahrir. I mean, most of the interesting conversations happen in Tahrir. And it's, you know, it's the feeling of standing shoulder to shoulder with people. I never went to interview. I ended up talking to people, but I went because I wanted to go, and I felt that, you know, I wanted to be with fellow Egyptians and not even listening, but just feeling the buzz of the crowd. And then, you know, you overhear a conversation and you stumble across a conversation, or someone comes and asks you a question. Or, I mean, different moments were generated differently. But I had, you know, over the past 2 years, many, many occasions. I went to demonstrations, I went to funerals, I went to the mosques, I went to the morgue for people who were killed by snipers. I went to hospitals. I go in solidarity. I go because, you know, I'm a professor. I sit, I have deadlines that I need to meet and I have things to do. But I feel actually something needs to be done. I am not a member of any party. So I feel that it's actually my body, my physical presence, just by being there. This is what matters. I do not want to talk. I do not want to listen to people. But it's probably precisely because of this that I had these interesting encounters. One of the most amazing encounters that I had was something that took 30 seconds, maybe. A conversation that was very quick. And it was a very difficult day. It was the day of the burning of the Institute of Egypt, the scientific institute that Napoleon had founded when he came to Egypt in 1798. I was there. I saw it being burnt. That day was particularly difficult because, if I may go back a bit on that day, I started the day in the morgue of Cairo because a woman friend of mine called me up and she said, "Have you heard about Ahmed Ifat, a very famous Sheikh of Al-Azhar, young, father of, I think, 4 children, very handsome young man with a religious garb who was organizing food to people in Tahrir. He was killed by a sniper." So the autopsy report is key in deciding how he was killed. So we went to the morgue to insist on an autopsy. And we spent the whole morning with the family of his family and 6 other victims. Then we marched with his body all the way from the morgue to Al-Azhar Mosque for the funeral. He's an Azhari sheikh. And in the mosque, the imam of Al-Azhar started giving a eulogy of him. And we're all attentive to how he would identify the cause of death. And he said natural death. It was the women who shut him down in Al-Azhar Mosque. And I have a video clip of it.
Al-Azhar Mosque, the Vatican of Egyptian Islam.
Yes, of Sunni Islam. Not only in Egypt, the whole Sunni world. It's a very important religious center. And the imam was shut down by women demonstrators in the courtyard of the mosque, telling him no, no. And the funeral turned into a demonstration. We took the body halfway across the city of 18 million people to bury him in his family plot. That was about 12 hours of this emotional thing. And then I said I'd swing by Tahrir because I heard there was a fire. So I went to Tahrir, and sure enough, there was the fire that engulfed that institute. And I saw these young kids raising themselves and going into the inferno to save whatever books that could be salvaged. And we stayed overnight trying to save as many books as could be saved. And then the following day, the fire brigade came hours later. Of course, now we know it was military police who did all of this, who put the institute on fire, blaming it on the young kids of Tahrir. That's why my presence was there. I saw with my own eyes these kids who later on was accused of all kinds of hooliganism, saving books. And so the fire brigade came and started drenching the whole place. I got drenched. And I stood in the sun to dry myself. And I was exhausted after basically 24 hours of this emotional and physical turmoil. And I saw this woman approaching me, looking me in the eye from a distance, a veiled woman, I mean, covering her hair, not her face. And she has a beautiful face with a beautiful smile, faint smile. And she looked me in the eye. She passed me by. And then she turned around. She said, "I know you. I've seen you before. Weren't you on TV the other day? Weren't you on TV talking about the demonstrations in Muhammad Mahmoud Street? And weren't you saying that the kids there were asking you, 'Sir, why are you here?'" I said, I was embarrassed. I said, "Yeah, it was me." She said, "Well, why are you here?" It was a class thing. And she's basically saying, "Why aren't you in your office? Or why aren't you, you know?" So I turned to her and I said, "Well, why are you here? I mean, I asked the same question to you." So she said, "My son is here." I said, "Where?" And then she just gestured with her hand towards Tahrir, which is the huge area. I said, "Where exactly?" She said, "I don't know. He's somewhere here, and I'm here to look for him." But she's not anxious. So I told her, "How old is your son?" She said, 16. So I said, "So how? Why is he here?" And she said, "His best friend was killed with a bullet in the stomach last week by the police. And he said, 'Mom, I'm not coming back before I get back his right.'"
Until I get back his...
Right. That's a slogan, you know, to avenge him, to avenge his friend who had been killed. That is when the confrontation turned bloody, and that is how the kid was killed in the first place, and that is why it was a cycle. The police was using live ammunition, was targeting people, specifically their eyes. So many people who lost their eyes by being targeted by snipers. So a 16-year-old guy who said, "You know, I cannot rest because my best friend had been killed by the police. I have to go and do something." What is it? He doesn't know, but he feels he cannot stay at home. And his mother, in turn, somehow feels the same thing. And I, in turn, also, in a different way, and none of these people are my relatives, but I feel like I too have to do something. I don't know what it is I do, but I ended up trying to save some books and marching in a demonstration and a funeral. And that's it. And it's in these things that you know, walking and talking, and you end up having an profound conversation about something very, very simple, but very, very human and very, very profound. We have a long way to go, you should not give up. This is not a revolution that will be over anytime soon.
You still call it a revolution?
Yes, given everything I've said, it is a revolution by all means. It's a cultural revolution. It's deeper than a political revolution. It's a cultural revolution. It's so deep in Egyptian history, in Egyptian psyche, that I cannot explain it or use any other term. It's a reversal of how Egyptians thought of themselves, thought of their government. It's not over in the sense that we don't have a political system that mirrors this new sentiment. We still don't know. We still don't have it. We don't have a constitution. We don't have people in power who reflect this. What we have is an outburst of energies, not all of them creative or positive, but energies that have been bottled up in the country for the past 200 years. The amazing thing is that this outburst happened in such a huge, big country with so many deep problems in such a peaceful way. That is what I think is most impressive. I think if I were a journalist, that would be the story. The story of what did not happen. And what did not happen is a civil war. Egypt could very well have ended up in a civil war. It's a big country with serious fault lines in its society, with very, very deep problems, and a very strong counter-revolutionary forces who do not want to see the culmination of this effort. And despite this, we managed to do a lot and do away with much of the former regime and to do this in a peaceful way. Now, I still call it a revolution because it is a reversal of some very, very basic beliefs and modes of behavior of the Egyptian people. As I tried to explain, it did not happen overnight. I could see the preparations or the way leading to it for some time now. And because it is indigenous, because it's authentic, because it has roots. So it's not a sudden outburst. Conservative counter-revolutionary forces are very, very strong, most importantly the Muslim Brotherhood. They are the ones who stood to benefit most for obvious reasons, mostly 8 years of organization, 8 years of tactical preparations, and 8 years of a very, very formidable political structure. The organization of the Muslim Brotherhood as an organization is a very, very well-greased, well-knit, well-financed political machine. When elections come, time come, they are the first to know how to turn out the vote. Their rhetoric is not that sophisticated. What they have to promise is very meager. I don't think they are the solution. But they know how to do things, and they do it. So that is what we now have. And in that sense, it looks like revolution has failed. But I personally think that having a president who was behind bars only 20 months ago is an amazing achievement. To have a president who had been ruling for 30 years behind bars is an amazing achievement. To do this not in a kangaroo trial, but in a legal way, without lynching him, without hanging him for a tree, is a significant achievement. To put all heads of the political establishment, the Speaker of Parliament, and the Speaker of Parliament is not behind bars, but many important figures of the former regime behind bars, is very, very important. And to start bit by bit dismantling this apparatus of tyranny will take a long time. The other option would have been blood, logically. You know, to see revolution the way people understand revolution would have been blood. With revolutionary trials, with guillotines or gallows in Tahrir, we didn't see this. But the underlying currents are still there. They're still very deep. There's a very high level of anxiety now because we still don't know which way the direction the revolution will go, especially with writing the constitution and the translation of the revolution into new institutional structures. But in the overall scheme of things, this is a huge reversal in the trajectory of Egyptian history.
Khaled Fahmy, thank you so much. This is exactly the long panorama that I hope to see. And let's hope you're right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.